Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zeb Larson, and we're here today with Dr. Peter James Hudson of UCLA to discuss his book, Bankers and Empire, How Wall Street Colonized the Caribbean. Focusing on the 1890s through the early 1930s, Dr. Hudson shows how North American bankers treated the Caribbean as a kind of laboratory to test out lending and financial practices. Unrestrained by regulation and at times acting as an arm of U.S. foreign policy, they wielded a powerful influence in the region. Dr. Hudson, welcome to the New Books Network. Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you went to school.
First of all, thank you for having me on the podcast to discuss bankers and empire. I'm currently an associate professor in the Departments of History and African American Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Before that, I had short stints at the History Department of Vanderbilt University and African American Studies at SUNY Buffalo. I completed my PhD in American Studies in 2007 at New York University. Before that, I was raised in Vancouver, went to Simon Fraser University there, and spent a little bit of time flitting around writing and editing before I returned to graduate school. And Bankers and Empire really emerges out of the kind of confluence of people and both people and intellectual interests that were circulating at New York University in the early 2000s.
So what was your dissertation about?
The dissertation was a history of banking, though very different than the resulting book. What the dissertation had more of a literary bent. I was really interested in kind of representations of capital, representations of race, and the kind of relationship between political economy and narratives of finance within literature. U.S. literature about the Caribbean. There is, to some degree, an archival component, but the dissertation was really kind of pulled in two directions. One, trying to grapple with this history of banking in the Caribbean, as well as a kind of question of literary representations of the Caribbean within financial discourses in the U.S. in the early 20th century. So the resulting book is really, I think, you know, there's probably one-tenth of the book of the dissertation is in the book, and the book is really a result of subsequent years of archival work since I finished the PhD.
And what was the archival process like for writing the book?
The short answer to that is that it was hell. I think the experience of a lot of young historians, and this isn't a critique of any kind of advising I received, because I think I was really well received. But historians are told, you know, you're a young historian or a young scholar, and you're said, well, just go into the archive and find something. And I as an undergrad, I hadn't studied history. I was fairly new to the discipline. And so even the ideas of archives were a little bit of a mystery to me. And when I first started talking to librarians about the, where does one find the archive of banking, of Caribbean banking, or of U.S. banking in the Caribbean, people didn't really know where to go. They hadn't really heard too much of this kind of project. So I kind of slowly realized that obviously the bankers themselves had these vast corporate archives. And naively, I wrote to a number of them. And I was like, look, I'm a graduate student, or just finished my PhD. And I'm really interested in researching the kind of venal and corrupt history of Wall Street in the Caribbean. And of course, that sent a red flag to the archivist. So they kind of immediately shut the door, on me. And this kind of happened with the Citibank, as well as with some of the Canadian banks that I talk about, the Royal Bank of Canada, the Bank of Montreal, the Bank of Nova Scotia. And so after that experience, I realized I had to kind of try a different strategy. And, you know, I realized that the National Archives and the records of the State Department were incredible sources for banking history, the kind of sets of correspondence between State Department officials and bankers on the Caribbean became a really, really valuable resource. I ended up using a lot of the kind of publications, the internal publications produced by the banks themselves that gave me information on locations and personnel and policy. And I found these in places like the New York Public Library, which was a real, really incredible resource for me. And then I started doing research, trying to figure out the names of individual bankers who were in the Caribbean. And I tried to track down any of their descendants to see if they might have personal papers. And so this was kind of research as a shot in the dark, effectively. And I found one banker in the Citibank journal, a journal called Number 8, I found copies of it in the New York Public Library as well as in the Yale University Library. And there was a banker that I came across named Joseph Durrell. And Durrell seemed to me to be a quite important figure in the history of the bank, of Citibank in the Caribbean. I could tell that he was from somewhere in the Midwest. He had ended up in Cuba in the early 20th century and then kind of moved through the ranks of the Citibank until he was the head of their international operations. And I was able to track down through a bunch of Google searches his granddaughter. And I wrote her blindly one day, and I was like, look, my name's Peter Hudson. I'm at this point, I was a professor at Vanderbilt, and I'm doing this research on banking. And I think that you may be the granddaughter of this figure named Joseph Durrell. This is what I know about him. And I'm just curious to know if he has any personal papers, memoirs, journals, letters, anything that he might have preserved from his time with the bank. And Durrell's granddaughter, Connie Sheehy, wrote back to me almost immediately. And she's like, you know, I am his granddaughter, and he has papers that are a historian's dream. And if you like, you can come and visit me or visit my brother and check them out. So I went to visit her. She was in the Northeast, and went to her brother's home, and he had a study with a big oak desk, and on the oak desk were something like 6 or 7 6-inch thick leather bound volumes that represented 2 different series. One was all his kind of his family history, that was basically a biography of his family and his own autobiography from the end of the 19th century until the 1950s. And the other set of documents was all his correspondence since he became a banker at the age of 17 through to his time with as a vice president of the international division of the Citibank. And so this was an absolute gold mine. It filled in a lot of the gaps in the research of material that I pulled from the State Department archives, as well as papers at Columbia University, the Vanderbilt and Stillman papers, which were 2 very important figures in the history of Citibank. And so not only did it give me a whole series of names, it gave me access to the kind of internal discussions around bank policy. And it also gave me a really kind of palpable sense of the personality of these bankers. They were no longer just kind of these flattened evil individuals, you know, who were just involved in U.S. imperialism as a kind of caricature, but they were very nuanced, complex beings who made decisions based on their own circumstances, their own time, what they thought was right and wrong. Occasionally, you would see egregiously racist statements from them, but you'd also find occasional real sympathy for Caribbean peoples and a real belief that their policies, even if they're based in paternalism, were for Caribbean development. So it allowed this. What I hope I was able to incorporate into this book is, on one level, a critique of the broad policies of bankers in the Caribbean, but also a sense of emotional nuance about how those policies were enacted.
I would say it also has another benefit for the book, which is that it's fundamentally driven by personalities. I mean, it contextualizes these larger phenomena, but it doesn't ever seem to me, when I was reading it, and I don't deal with financial history, like this is just a history of sovereign debt and how Absolutely. It was manipulated in the Caribbean. There are actual human beings on the page in every chapter. But let's stop teasing our audience. Let's dive into the meat of this book, Bankers and Empire, How Wall Street Colonized the Caribbean. What would you say it's about?
Well, Bankers and Empire reconstructs the history of the expansion of Wall Street banking houses and financial institutions, including the precursors to Citigroup and JPMorgan Chase, into the Caribbean region, including Haiti, Cuba, Panama, the Dominican Republic, and Puerto Rico, during a period stretching from the end of the 19th century until the onset of the Great Depression. This period represented an initial exploratory era of the internationalization of U.S. banking, and the Caribbean region was Wall Street's laboratory for foreign expansion. As such, the history I recount was marked by experimentation in the organizational and managerial apparatus of foreign banking, challenges to the legal orders governing the regulation of international trade and finance, and the development and training of a first cohort of international managers and bank officers. In addition, in Bankers and the Empire, I try to demonstrate that this history was as much one of race and culture as it was of economics and money. The putatively financial concerns of Wall Street were embedded in and understood through racist discourses and ideas of racial difference. Bankers and Empire argues that the history of U.S. imperialism, Wall Street's internationalization, the development of finance capitalism was braided through the history of racial capitalism. And finally, while the early 20th century history of Wall Street's internationalization rode a euphoric wave of U.S. nationalism and expansion, in reality, it was a period marked by its repeated failures, corruption, military interventions and occupations, financial and economic crises, and Caribbean resistance to imperialism put a brake on Wall Street's ambitions. The book consists of 7 chapters, plus an introduction and a conclusion, and I can kind of go through what those 7 chapters are. The introduction is titled Dark Finance, and it provides a real overview of the major themes, analytical issues, and historical problems discussed within the larger book. Here I illustrate how domestic economic and financial crisis accelerated Wall Street's internationalization, how crisis sparks debate concerning the reform and modernization of regulations governing U.S. foreign banking. Indeed, I try to show that regulation is a critical concern for Wall Street, as banking is really based on the legal organization of the accumulation and distribution of capital. The problem of foreign banking represented in part the problem of the extension of regulation across national and regional boundaries and over the uneven, disordered, and plural legal geographies of international markets. The goal for Wall Street was to create the financial instruments and the legal organizations that could extend over this complex geography while navigating both domestic restrictions and regional sovereignty. More often than not, this navigation occurred by evading such restrictions, ignoring such sovereignty, and operating in the seams between jurisdictions and in the shadowed, unregulated spaces of global finance. Now, while Wall Street's corporate lawyers were critical in developing the legal entity for such negotiations, so too were what I call rogue bankers, and these are the people that you just mentioned. These are the lower level clerks, managers, and accountants who were really the foot soldiers of U.S. finance capital in the Caribbean. these rogue bankers sutured together the tattered legal geographies of international banking for the purposes of capital accumulation. They also highlighted the ways in which racism, more specifically white supremacy, was operationalized through the institutional mechanisms of finance capitalism and imperialism.
So let's start with one of those rogue bankers. Let's look at Cuba, which is where you begin the book in many ways.
Right. Well, in Cuba, Cuba at the end of the 19th century, in Santiago de Cuba in the end of the 19th century, there arrived a figure named Samuel Miller Jarvis. He was a Midwestern banker who had created, with his partner Roland Ray Conklin, the Jarvis Conklin Mortgage Trust Company, which was basically one of the most important institutions for kind of lending capital from the East and from England to kind of irrigate the Middle West and the West. And so Jarvis, Samuel Miller Jarvis, is really a figure, an important figure in kind of financial relations of settler colonialism at the end of the 19th century. By the crash of 93, he kind of turns from the West and starts to look for other places to make money. Effectively, he ends up in New York, and then soon thereafter ends up in Cuba. Soon after the conclusion of the Spanish-American War, and he opens up the first U.S. bank in Cuba, which is a branch of the North American Trust Company. The North American Trust Company works closely with McKinley's government. In some cases, some people said that it became a way for McKinley's brother, Abner McKinley, to bilk the Cuban people of money. But it becomes this very important institution in terms of both the role both the financing of the U.S. military presence in Cuba, and later in terms of the development of central banking in post-independence Cuba, where it morphs into an institution called the Banco Nacional de Cuba and effectively becomes the Cuban government's central bank. Jarvis is a quite brilliant entrepreneur. He's also seen as utterly corrupt. Many of the people who worked with him in the Midwest follow him to Cuba, and they end up in Cuba with reputations for having collapsed their companies under the shadow of the crisis of 1893, but as a way to kind of bilk investors of profits, which they then plow into Cuba, and then do the same thing first in Cuba and later in the Dominican Republic. One of the most important things for me about Jarvis, he's really a kind of understudied figure in the history of U.S. finance. But many of the people who work for him end up working for the Citibank, for the Chase, for Brown Brothers, for other institutions. And so there's a way in which the kind of methods that he's espousing as a banker with the North American Trust Company and his other institutions then kind of migrate to the Chase, to the Citibank, to Brown Brothers, and people like Joseph H. Durrell, who I mentioned, and other bankers, all kind of got to start with Jarvis's Caribbean operations. And so the kind of story of Samuel Miller Jarvis is really the story of the first chapter of the book.
And then in the second chapter, you move us to Panama. What's going on in Panama?
Yeah, so the second chapter looks at these a series of institutions that exist before the signing of the Federal Reserve at the end of 1913. And what I'm arguing here is that period before 1913 is this really interesting kind of free space for banking. And so there's an attempt by all kinds of entrepreneurs and crooks in some cases to create what are called these kind of Pan-American or international banking institutions, banks that can go into Mexico, go into Cuba, go into South America, and in some cases go into Asia, that can both work for the War Department and and work for the kind of emerging U.S. commercial and corporate interests throughout the world. And so I tell the story of a number of these institutions, most of whom fail within a couple years of operation, many of whom were only set up to bilk their customers. But then I focus on what becomes the kind of granddaddy of international banking, what's often considered the first U.S. international bank. And this is the International Banking Corporation, an institution that's founded in 1902 by a lawyer and industrialist by the name of Thomas H. Hubbard. Hubbard has ties to railroads, to gun interests, to all kinds of different corporate interests in the U.S., and he works to make the International Banking Corporation, in the first instance, the kind of government repository for the U.S. presence in Panama, in the Philippines, and China. In the case of Panama, he wants to use it as an intermediary to help finance the building of the Panama Canal. In China, he's hoping to use the bank as an intermediary for the payment of the Chinese indemnity. And in the Philippines, he's hoping to use it to in the first instance, to pay U.S. soldiers, but in the second instance, to develop industrial concerns in the Philippines. Are you there?
I'm still here.
Okay. And again, this is another kind of pioneering institution in the history of American foreign banking. Many later bankers, including people with the Citibank, really covet the international banking institution because it's got this very unique charter that is basically a double charter, where you have on one level the International Banking Corporation, which is a Connecticut chartered institution being chartered in Connecticut. It's legally able to establish foreign branches and other activities. But there's also a parallel bank that's chartered in New York called the American Bank, which is used for kind of domestic commercial concerns in New York. And the Citibank in particular really looks to the International Banking Corporation as a model to think about how they might go ahead with their own foreign expansion, because they're hampered in their expansion by the National Bank Act. And they eventually, after the signing of the Federal Reserve System, Federal Reserve Act, purchase the International Banking Corporation and use it to expand their own international presence after 1914.
So then, I mean, Chapter 3, I think, really beautifully moves into role of the Citibank, but it also shifts location on us again, and this time into Haiti. What's going on in Haiti?
Well, and I think Chapter 3 and Chapter 4 need to be seen as kind of parallel chapters. Both of them deal with the Citibank. The Chapter 4 looks at the Citibank in Haiti. Chapter 3 looks at the Citibank in Haiti. Chapter 4 looks at the Citibank first in Cuba, but then through its entire international presence. And what's important about the Citibank in Haiti is, in some ways, their history there is part of the kind of darkest and most violent episode in the bank's history. Very early on, I think in about 1910, the Citibank thinks, you know, they're embarking on a period of expansion. They're looking for ways to control the finances of other countries by taking over central banks and becoming involved in commercial banking. And they become involved in Haiti with the end goal of taking over the French-controlled Haitian State Bank. It's, you know, to kind of compress the story, along the way, Haiti's going through its own internal turmoil. And in order to protect the bank's interests in that country, the managers of the Citibank in Haiti call on the State Department for military intervention. And military intervention eventually occurs in 1915, leading to a 19-year occupation that lasts until 1934. And so what I'm trying to argue here is not only does Haiti represent this kind of important and neglected moment in the history of cities banks internationalization, but the actual strategy of military occupation, of the use of U.S. Marines to protect the bank's interests, are a kind of integral part of the policy and the thinking of the of Wall Street and of the Citibank in particular, as they move into the Caribbean and Central America.
So here's a question I have. You can see these gray areas where suddenly American bankers are going out and in effect almost acting as agents of the United States. What happens as the U.S. government starts to notice what they're doing? Are they working together? Is state generally pretty comfortable with the way that Citibank, for example, goes out and operates? What's sort of the U.S. government perspective on this?
It's a very kind of complex relations. And it's a relationship that's marked by both complicity and contradiction. I mean, certainly the U.S. government encouraged and supported the internationalization of U.S. banking. At the end of the 19th century, U.S. politicians saw an American international banking presence as necessary to the development of what they called the manliness of the country. And they called for regulatory reform that would get rid of kind of the outmoded banking legislation of the National Bank Act and would support the foreign expansion of Wall Street. And then, you know, as we both suggested, after 1898, the war and state departments required fiscal agencies to support the infrastructure of U.S. colonialism in Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and financial institutions were an important conduit of colonial policy and financial and commercial diplomacy. Meanwhile, provisions in the Federal Reserve Act explicitly encouraged the development of a foreign branch network for U.S. banks, something that really didn't exist before 1914, and encouraged the creation of the kind of domestic cartels that would have been illegal in the U.S., but were permitted for overseas to finance foreign trade. But as you know, in some cases, such as in Haiti and Nicaragua, bankers encouraged the landing of U.S. troops in order to protect their interests. Now, at the same time, although foreign policy was often dictated from Lower Manhattan, and the federal government, alongside the U.S. military, came to protect U.S. banking and investment abroad, Wall Street often clashed with Washington. In Cuba in the late 1920s, for instance, the State Department was becoming increasingly frustrated with the Chase Bank's handling of loans to Cuban dictator Gerardo Machado. And they saw the bank's activities as a deliberate evasion of the Platt Amendment, which was supposed to restrict the Cuban government's abilities to take on further debt. And so the State Department actually saw what the Chase was doing as something that would push the Cuban government towards further instability. And by the 1930s, you know, kind of spurred by the revelations on banking practices revealed by Fernand Pécor and the Senate Committee on Banking and Currency, by the Pécor Commission, President Roosevelt enacted legislation that could curtail the activities of bankers both domestically and internationally. So, you know, in sum, I think it's not like you can say simply that the U.S. government supported bankers at all times. I mean, certainly there's egregious instances of complicity and graft by individual members of different U.S. cabinets. There's a kind of direct line between Washington and Wall Street in terms of banking policy and the shaping of banking policy. And some people were even critical of the Federal Reserve Act because it was seen as something that was just drawn up by J.P. Morgan, Frank Vanderlip of the Citibank, James Stillman of the Citibank, simply to serve the interests of the bankers. And they felt that the various legislators were in the bankers' pockets. But there was moments when the U.S. government realized that the activities of bankers was actually a kind of threat to the stability of the region, a threat to the United States of themselves, and so acted to curtail the activities of Wall Street in the Caribbean.
Fascinating. Well, let's not jump ahead too far. I had one other question I wanted to consider. You know, I was struck reading this by the extent to which
Canadian banks actually popped up here. Royal Bank of Canada repeatedly, the Bank of Montreal, Bank of Nova Scotia. So this is sort of a two-part question. How are American banks working alongside their Canadian counterparts? And does American banking behavior in this period, how does it compare to the other imperial powers that are operating around the globe?
Great questions. You know, and it's funny for me. I think the thing, you know, I'm a Canadian. I grew up in Vancouver. I grew up with, you know, under the shadows of these Canadian banks. My father's from Jamaica, and if you're from anywhere in the Anglophone Caribbean, you grew up with the Bank of Nova Scotia, with the Royal Bank of Canada, the Bank of Montreal, the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. But I was surprised by the degree with which they started to emerge in my research. I didn't realize the extent to which Canadian bankers were later became the real active competitors of Wall Street in the region. But initially, Canadian bankers, you know, they had a long-standing link to the Caribbean from the middle of the 19th century through the kind of maritime exchanges of maritime Canada with the British Caribbean, with the kind of exchanges of rum and cod in the 19th century. But by the end of the 19th century, and especially after the Spanish-American-Cuban War, the Royal Bank in particular realized that there was an opportunity in Cuba. They saw U.S. and Canadian investment capital flowing into the country. They realized that trade with Cuba was increasing, but they also realized that U.S. domestic banking legislation, again, this is the National Bank Act here, explicitly prohibited the establishment of branch banks by national banking associations like the Citibank. What this meant was that they could go into Cuba and Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic and to some degree Haiti and act as surrogates for American banking interests. So they ended up really working with, they would establish branches in Cuba, but also agencies in New York City and Chicago, and in some case Chicago or New York capitalists would invest heavily in the Canadian banks. And then they would kind of work together to finance the expansion of railroads, sugar, et cetera, throughout the region. So Canadian banks acted as surrogates, and also became, and again in Cuba especially, became real competitors with the American banks in terms of branch banking. The major difference between the activities of the U.S. and Canadian banks was in the provision of sovereign debt. We don't see the Royal Bank of Canada or the Bank of Nova Scotia lending money to Caribbean governments. This really becomes this is the province of American bankers. And when it comes to kind of questions of speculation, of corruption, of some of the egregious practices that I describe in the book, certainly the Canadian banks are as active in terms of the overexpansion of branch banking after the First World War. They're in some cases just as active as the U.S. banks in kind of over-speculation on sugar. But the main difference is when it comes to sovereign debt and the provision of sovereign debt of the loans to especially the Cuban government, they're not involved. And this becomes like the territory of the American bankers. And this is where we see, especially with the Chase, the kind of egregious and unhinged and speculative forms of financing that lead to so many problems within the Cuban economy. So again, it's a question, you know, in some ways they're both competing with the U.S. bankers. They're doing their own thing, they're surrogates to the U.S. bankers. And in some fields, they're just as corrupt and, overly exuberant, and in other places they're a little bit more conservative. And then going to the second part of the question in terms of British and French bankers, I think what's important to realize here is in the first instance, the French bankers, especially in Haiti, had a horrible reputation. They were seen as, first of all, they were seen as profiting from the reparations debt that Haiti had to take on in the 19th century in exchange for diplomatic recognition by France of Haiti. And then through the 19th and early 20th century until the U.S. bankers really became involved in Haiti, the French banks were seen as just bilking the country of money. And in some cases, Haitian governments would throw French bankers in jail, you know, for their corrupt practices. The British bankers, from what I could see, were somewhat more conservative. But in both cases, what the issue became during the First World War, European capital was basically retreated from the region. It was so tied up in European affairs that this created an opportunity for the U.S. and the Canadian bankers to get involved in the Caribbean. And I don't think the European bankers ever really returned in any significant way to the Caribbean after that. And I think the final thing that's important to realize here, and I wish more could be written about this, is one also has to take account of the role and the activities of indigenous banking. The attempts by Cubans, Haitians, Dominicans to kind of create their own banking institutions. And you see there's a very interesting moment immediately after the First World War, especially in Cuba, where there's this kind of, you know, growth of the Cuban banking industry. It's totally unchecked. It's unregulated. It's speculative. It collapses, allowing foreign bankers to come in. But there's a kind of interesting and lost history of an indigenous banking sector, and potentially, you know, what the possibilities of what an indigenous banking sector might mean in the long term for questions of Caribbean economic sovereignty. I don't necessarily explore that in the book, but I think it's something that is worth looking into.
No, that sounds absolutely fascinating, and like work does need to be done on that. For any prospective PhD candidates who might be listening in on this, you should take heed of that advice. So let's move to the fifth chapter where you talk about Mercantile Bank of the Americas. What's the MBA? What does it do?
Well, in the first instance, I have to say that the fifth chapter is actually one of my favorite chapters in the book, so I'm very happy to talk about it. And I think the Mercantile Bank of the Americas is one of these institutions that I kind of discovered a few references in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal in the 1920s, and found in different archives references to different parts of its history. In short, the Mercantile Bank of the Americas emerged as the single largest American international bank after World War I. It was founded about, I think, in around 1919. It was led by a consortium of bankers, at the forefront of which were J&W Seligman, the investment bankers, Brown Brothers and Company, and J.P. Morgan and Company. And they got together to organize this vehicle that could effectively take over central banks and commercial banks throughout the Caribbean and Latin America. And their growth, and they were, first of all, they were enabled by the Federal Reserve Act and the kind of new banking legislation that created the legal machinery to facilitate the forward expansion of American banking. And they quickly went out into the field and created this incredible network of branch banks that were subsidiaries of the parent bank in New York, as well as semi-autonomous local and central banks. And so they basically created this near monopoly on banking in the Americas. But as rapid as their rise was, so too was their fall. They were blighted by overexpansion, by managerial incompetence, by personal corruption, and by market instability. And by the 1920s, it proved that this kind of network that they had created was extremely frail, and that there was difficulties of communication between New York and the subsidiaries throughout the region. And it collapsed in this huge explosion. This is one of the kind of narratives of failure and the limits of U.S. imperialism that become central to the book. And it becomes a kind of cautionary tale for bankers during this period about that expansion. But again, another opportunity for other bankers, especially the Citibank, the Chase, and the Royal Bank of Canada, to kind of take over the kind of skeletal forms of the branch banks, of the Mercantile Bank of the Americas throughout the region. And just as a kind of footnote to that story, it's in this chapter that I really talk about Nicaragua. And we've heard about Nicaragua as being the kind of Republic of Brown Brothers. And this actually meant that that it was the Republic of the Mercantile Bank of the Americas, because it was Brown Brothers through the Mercantile Bank of the Americas that controlled the Nicaraguan central bank, printed their currency, had the currency had the signature of Brown Brothers officials authorizing it, and it was through the bank that Brown Brothers encouraged U.S. military intervention into the region. And I think that the story of the kind of rise of a kind of revolutionary nationalism in Nicaragua under Augusto Sandino generally neglects to talk about this, the role of the Mercantile Bank of the Americas and their kind of corporate expansion in fomenting the conditions for the kind of peasant revolts that we see by the end of the 1920s and early 1930s.
Hmm. Then transition to chapter 6. This is where Durrell gets to show up, and he's a large character. What's he doing in this period?
Absolutely. So this in chapter 6 talks about the kind of attempts of the Citibank to develop a new strategy and a new policy after the kind of banking collapse of 1920-21. And this is a banking collapse that through which the Mercantile Bank of the Americas gets shuttered, but it also for the Citibank, they realize that their own branch expansion has been too quick. They've set up too many branches. They've staffed them with too many incompetent people. They've overinvested in sugar. They've put money on dubious sugar contracts, and this hits them hard. It almost, you know, the kind of collapse of the price of sugar and the kind of bottoming up of these sugar loans almost brings down the Citibank in 1920-21. And so out of this, the Citibank directors realize that they have to develop a new strategy. By this time, James Stillman, who was a kind of patriarch within the bank and who guided the bank from the end of the 19th century when it was a merchant bank or kind of, you know, merchant slash commercial bank into this powerful international entity. He's gone. He's died. Frank Vanderlip, who's a kind of technocratic genius who oversees the expansion of the bank in the Caribbean, who's this kind of liberal and progressive thinker when it comes to questions of international and banking expansion questions. He's pushed out, and the bank turns, the directors of the bank turn to this kind of young, good-looking, dashing, hyper-masculine guy by the name of Charles Mitchell. And Mitchell was basically a salesman who had been recruited by Vanderlip previously, but they see Mitchell as a kind of figure who can right the ship of the Citibank and take it in new directions. Mitchell gets rid of most of the personnel that Vanderlip's hired. He gets rid of many of the individual units that Vanderlip's had created, and he consolidates power with himself and a small group of vice presidents. And so, where Vanderlip had kind of created a huge managerial network, Mitchell effectively returns to one-party rule and gets rid of a lot of these people, and then takes the bank on a whole new series of strategies. One of the people that he hires is Joseph H. Durrell, who I mentioned earlier in terms of his family and his archives. He becomes increasingly important within the bank, and he's the one who really is on the ground, first of all in Cuba, hiring and firing the staff that had been hired by previous managers, reducing the branch network, and trying to figure out new strategies of accumulation within the bank. His success and his loyalty to Mitchell sees him within a decade move from manager of Cuban branches to head of the Caribbean district with the Dominican Republic, Panama, Haiti, etc., to the head of all of South America, and then finally to basically the head of its global banking operations. Unfortunately for Mitchell, or excuse me, for Durrell, who's a very ambitious, very smart man, and in some ways a very old school banker who believes in, you know, high reserve requirements, who doesn't believe in speculation. You know, he ends up working for a gentleman, Charles Mitchell, who's exactly the opposite. Mitchell is all about speculation. It's all about loaning as much as the bank's capital as possible for dubious ventures, and is all about expansion. So even when he's loyal to Mitchell, tries to rein in Mitchell at times, you know, his efforts basically fail, and this leads to, you know, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but this leads to the kind of near collapse of the bank again in the 1930s, and eventually the breakup of the bank in the 1930s.
So then the seventh chapter, titled Odious Debt, is great to me because it seems to be the logical culmination of these at best sort of ill-formed and shady banking practices. It's also a lot about Chase. What's going on?
Absolutely. So it's the seventh chapter is basically both the history of the Chase in general, but a history of the Chase in the Caribbean, and specifically, it's an institution that's founded in the 1870s and goes through a kind of rapid period of domestic expansion up until around 1913, 1914. At this time, they start to look overseas. They form a subsidiary called the American Foreign Banking Corporation that suffers the same fate of the Mercantile Bank of the Americas. It goes through a period of expansion, but the expansion is marked by all kinds of corruption and bad business practices, and it collapses. In the wake of the collapse of the American Foreign Banking Corporation, the Chase turns to what's called its security affiliate, a kind of parallel institution that allows the bank to do certain things that allows them to do certain things that are not actually permitted under national banking legislation. So the Chase is a commercial bank. The securities affiliate, which is called the Chase Securities Corporation, allows them to get involved in investment banking. The Chase Security Corporation also facilitates their expansion into the Caribbean, and the directors of the Chase realize that, and especially its president, Albert Wiggins, realize that their way to compete with the Citibank, in particular, is to fight with them over sovereign debt issue. And so they're trying to loan as much money as possible to as many Caribbean and Latin American countries as possible. And they do it without any kind of regard for the ability of these countries to pay them off. And in Cuba, this becomes the most egregious, where they aggressively sought to fund the government of Gerardo Machado and offer him all kinds of money that he's using for his own vanity projects, even as the Cuban people are starving. But by the end of the 1920s, the Chase starts to get into trouble. The price of sugar, which is a staple of the Cuban economy, basically flatlines. It never reaches the heights that it was during the First World War. The government of Machado, which was democratically elected, morphs into a dictatorship as he refuses to have further elections. And the Cuban people increasingly are feeling like the Chase Bank is propping him up, and that the loans that the Chase Bank makes to Cuba are illegal or odious, that they're a form of odious debt, that they're odious because they were contracted by an illegal and illegitimate government. And so there's a kind of movement among Cuban politicians, especially once Machado goes into exile in the early 1930s, where the Cuban people are like, we refuse to make payments. We refuse to make the amortization payments on this debt because they're illegal. And so there's this kind of extended legal battle between the Cuban government and the Chase Bank are around these debts. In the end, the Cuban government wins, the Chase Bank wins, and the Cuban government is forced to pay the debt. But it creates this kind of longstanding animosity and kind of anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, anti-Wall Street sentiment within the country towards the Chase, but also towards the Citibank, the Royal Bank of Canada. And, you know, one could argue that it's the kind of economic crisis that was created by the lending practices of the Chase in the 1920s and that eventually led to the Cuban Revolution in 1959, because a kind of crisis, the economic crisis of the 1920s and the bank crisis of the 1920s had kind of repercussions throughout the rest of the 20th century.
Hmm. And what's the domestic effect in the United States?
So the domestic effect is interesting. And I mean, just as an anecdote here, one of the archives that I found, the archives that I found in the National Archives were the archives of the Pecora Commission papers. And Fernand Pecora was this young lawyer who was kind of given carte blanche and subpoena power to investigate the practices of Wall Street in the face of the financial crisis in the wake of the financial crisis of 1929. And one thing you find in those papers is an entire file of people who are writing to his team of lawyers, and in some cases saying, look, a Chase salesman or a Citibank salesman came to my house, promised me these returns on some Cuban sugar company or a Dominican sugar company. I gave my life savings. Now I'm destitute. There's hundreds of letters from all over the country, alongside letters from people in Cuba complaining about the practices of the of Wall Street. And so we see that at this moment that the Caribbean people and American citizens are deeply tied together through the practices of Wall Street. They're both suffering from these practices. And out of that, you see a groundswell, as I suggested, of opposition to Wall Street in the Caribbean itself. And this is at the level of everyone from, you know, Cuban peasants to Cuban workers to the Cuban government. But you also see this kind of groundswell of opposition and frustration to the international practices of Wall Street amongst U.S. citizens, people in the Midwest, people who never have traveled to Cuba, but who saw the promises of the investment in Cuban sugar or Argentine wheat or whatever it is, as their hope for security. And then suddenly these two populations are linked together through this crisis. And it emboldens, I think, the investigators into the bankers and emboldens the Roosevelt in terms of trying to deal with these bankers. And the bankers themselves are, you know, the revelations about their activities are coming out, and they're chastened. They've gone from the kind of highs of the 1920s into the doldrums of the 1930s, and that they realize that even though they think they've done everything right and through all their practices, they realize that, look, we have to do something to change our appearance. We have to, you know, support the withdrawal of Marines from Haiti. We have to support the development of domestic banking reform as well as banking reform in Cuba. So I think there's this interesting story that perhaps still needs to be told. And again, you know, for some prospective graduate student out there, about the kind of domestic responses of American citizens to the international implications of this financial crisis.
Fascinating. I have to ask. I'm thinking of books like Mary Renda's book about Haiti, where she talks about the significance of the occupation of Haiti for African Americans in the 1920s. Right. And do you get any sense that African Americans in the United States are looking at these banking practices specifically, critiquing them?
Absolutely. I think in the first instance, with say the U.S. occupation of Haiti, in the early years of the occupation, I think many African Americans were no different than white Americans or State Department officials in terms of their perceptions of Haiti. They saw it as backward, corrupt, a place of savagery. Not all African Americans, but there's a good part of the population that actually supported U.S. intervention as a way to reform and stabilize this Black Republic. But you then begin to see people like W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, Hubert Harrison, a little bit later George Padmore, and then probably most importantly, James Weldon Johnson of the National Association of Colored People, who go to Haiti, or at least what Weldon Johnson goes to Haiti and spends about 5 months there investigating the conditions in Haiti and investigating the activities of the Marines. And it's really through the work of publicity that the opinion of finance capitalism and Wall Street in the Caribbean changes. James Weldon Johnson begins an article in The Nation in 1922 by saying that the National City Bank of New York is effectively responsible for the U.S. occupation of Haiti, and its vice president, Roger Farnham, is the U.S. government's point person in Haiti, and goes from there to describe all kinds of marine atrocities and the ways in which Wall Street is imposing foreign loans on a kind of on Haiti itself. So, you know, there's an interesting kind of shift that you see by the 1920s, where I think many African Americans were kind of living in a certain kind of ignorance about what was going on in the Caribbean, and partly because of the lack of coverage of what was going on there, to this moment where alongside the rest of the U.S. population, they began to see what was really happening there. And then I think African Americans become some of the biggest advocates for the return of sovereignty, of sovereignty in Haiti and other places to Caribbean people, and the withdrawal of Marines and the withdrawal of U.S. finance capital. And I would also say that characterize someone like James Weldon Johnson as a kind of steady liberal, even though he wrote some very radical articles on the occupation. The people who also did a lot of publicity there was the Communist Party, especially through their so-called Negro wings. And this is where a figure like George Padmore and other people become important, because he writes articles, you know, titled, I think I'm paraphrasing here, things like, you know, U.S. imperialism enslaves Haiti, U.S. imperialism enslaves Liberia. And these articles circulate not just in communist publications, but also in, you know, the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, the Amsterdam News, you know. And so the average African-American is reading these very critical articles and these very radical articles about conditions in Haiti, and begin to see that the experience of Haitians is not unlike the experience of African Americans, where Haitians are being lynched by U.S. Marines, African Americans are being lynched in the United States. And so it's easy then to see a kind of parallel and a kind of line of affiliation and solidarity, which then leads to further protests within the country on behalf of Caribbean people by African Americans.
Fascinating. I've taken up a lot of your time today, so I wanted to ask just one more question. What are you thinking of working on right now?
Great question. And a question I would love to spend another hour talking about. But I've actually, you know, it's for me, this has been an amazing project to work on, because I feel like I've entered so many territories that I really knew nothing about before I started. But there was also something very alienating about telling, you know, spending 10 years telling the story of a handful of dead white guys. And I think one of the questions that I was always getting as I was trying to write and research the book is like, well, what about the question of resistance? How did people resist these bankers? And I thought it was important for me to tell the story the way I did, and to really get into the minds and the histories of these bankers. But it's a question that kind of lingered with me. And so I've enjoyed the kind of biographical element of the narrative, and I want to take that kind of biographical mode of writing and apply it to one of the figures I just mentioned, George Padmore. Mm. And Padmore was born at the beginning of the 20th century, came to the United States in the 1920s, went first to Fisk University, then to Howard University, and then at some point in the 1920s, about 1927, joined the Communist Party and became one of its most important kind of Negro functionaries. He traveled to Africa. He traveled to Europe. He spent time in Moscow trying to train and recruit Black revolutionaries. Until the early 1930s, he had a serious break with Moscow over their kind of what he saw as a retreat from an anti-imperialist policy and support for the sovereignty of African, Asian, and Caribbean nations. And so at that point, he embarks on a kind of period of independent Pan-Africanism, or what he calls Pan-African socialism, where he's willing to work with people like Marcus Garvey, who he initially, as a communist, was against, as well as people like C.L.R. James, Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya. And so through the middle of the 20th century, Padmore is living in London, working as a journalist, writing on the colonies and sending his dispatches out to the African-American press and the African press. And all the time he's working to advocate for the decolonization of Africa, specifically kind of shifts from, you know, his Caribbean roots to focus on Africa, because he sees that Africa, if Africa becomes independent, that will become the kind of a way for Caribbean nations to follow. His kind of dreams of independence are first realized in Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana and its independence. But soon thereafter, he dies of a kind of mysterious pancreas ailment. And so for me, Padmore is a figure who he's much dismissed within the historiography. A lot of people see him as a kind of wacky Pan-Africanist, but he's also somebody who has, to me, a quite incredible story. He's publishing the whole time, he's writing the whole time, and he knows every activist throughout the world, and he sticks by this kind of this vision of independent Pan-Africanism. And so I'm really interested in trying to recover Padmore as a figure within African history, but also within African diaspora history, and I think also within the history of capitalism, someone who has a kind of consistent line of critique of capitalism. So I'm, I think the next 10 years will be spent trying to write Padmore's biography.
Wonderful. That'll be a valuable addition, I think. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
And thank you. It's been a pleasure.